live on DAZN Worldwide.
Saudi Arabia.
Saturday, May 3rd, 7 p.m. Eastern. Canelo versus Skull. The King stakes his legacy once more for the undisputed crown. Standing in his way is Warrior Skull, undefeated and poised to decimate the division on a knockout weekend of boxing.
Let's make history.
Get Canelo versus Skull, Saturday, May 3rd, 7 p.m. Eastern, live exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com.
You know who you are?
Steven is my name.
Even Steven.
Will you say something, Steven?
Steven or else media.
Meanwhile, at the Franks and Beans comic book store.
Good morning, Virgil.
Oh, hey, Chuck. Wasn't expecting you back so soon. You get your eggs?
I did, thank you.
Well, that's great. You on another mission for your wife?
Why, yes, Virgil. In fact, I am. It's my nephew's birthday tomorrow. Little Tyke is turning 8. And my wife sent me forth to procure for him some sort of gift. And I couldn't help noticing the last time I was here that you sold action figures.
Yes, we do. Any particular kind you're looking...
No. Not today, Chuck. Never again. I want you out of my store. I don't understand. Have I done something to offend you, Abner?
Yeah, Abner, what the heck?
He's a murderer, Virgil. He killed that letter carrier. Said so himself last week.
You know what? Now that you mention it, I do recall him saying something about shooting a letter carrier and burying him under his house. Well, Chuck, what do you have to say for yourself?
Well, to tell the truth, gents, gosh, this is rather embarrassing. Spit it out, Chuck. Well, to be honest, I made the whole thing up.
You made it up?
You mean you ain't never killed nobody? Of course not. Then why'd you say it? I said it because I wanted the two of you to think I was cool.
That's pretty messed up, Chuck.
Yes, I know. I'm sorry, gents. It's just, well, I have what doctors refer to as crippling social issues. I never know how to act around people and... Well, you both seem to be such swell fellas that I wanted to impress you.
You scared the crap out of me, Chuck. That's what you did.
Funny, you didn't seem scared at the time.
Abner deals with fear by being rude.
Ah, yes, I suppose that makes sense.
Were you looking for anything in particular, Chuck, or is this just a social call?
Well, as I was telling Virgil, I'm in the market to purchase one of your action figures.
Great. You got your eyes on any specific ones?
In fact, I do. My nephew has always been rather partial to the old cartoon about that muscly gent, tough guy. You know it?
Are you kidding? He's tough.
He's a guy.
He's a tough guy.
Yes, indeed, that's the one.
Well, you're in luck. Not only do we have a tough guy in stock, but all of our action figures are on sale.
A sale? How fortuitous! What are your terms, shopkeeper?
Virgil, I'm gonna leave you to it. I need to make a run to the bank. See you around, Chuck!
Yes, you too, Abner. I will see you around the places in which social people congregate.
See you, Abner.
Now back to it, Virgil. Tell me about this sale.
All of our action figures, till the end of the month... They're buy one, get one free.
Goodness gracious, fortune does smile upon me this day. The action figures are free.
Well, yes, technically. You buy one, and then you get one for free.
Oh, wait a minute. So I have to buy two of them?
Not unless you want four. Otherwise, you only need to buy one, and then you get the second one for free.
Well, now I'm confused. I only need one, but you're telling me that if I want a free one, I have to buy one?
That's right.
Well, why would I buy two tough guy action figures, Virgil? What am I going to do with the second one?
Well, you don't have to get two of the same thing, Chuck. Buy tough guy, and then get his evil nemesis. Bad Brain, you get him for free.
Well, what am I going to do with the Bad Brain action figure? I'm a grown man.
Well, give them both to your nephew.
Oh, come now, Virgil. Two action figures for his birthday? I have no wish to spoil the child.
Well, you could buy a tough guy, get Bad Brain for free, then hold on to him and give him to your nephew. You for Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever.
Can't I just take Tough Guy for free and leave Bad Brain here?
Well, I'm sorry, Chuck, but that ain't the way it works. You gotta buy one to get the other one for free.
This is a real puzzler, Virgil. I can't seem to wrap my head around it. How can it be free if I have to pay?
Well, you're getting two action figures, Chuck, but you ain't paying for both of them. That's how it works. You're paying for one, but you're getting two.
But I'm still paying, Virgil. I'm still handing over my money. How is that free?
All right, think of it like this. You're buying two action figures at 50% off.
Let me get my calculator.
From a secret location deep within the hills of eastern Kansas, one man armed only with a microphone, his voice, and an almost supernatural gift for hyperbole, brings you the most important podcast in all of human history. It's time to escape from the mundane, ladies and gentlemen. This is Stephen or Else. Hello and welcome to another episode of Stephen or Else, the podcast in which I get to do whatever I damn well please. I'm your host. My name is Stephen. And this, my friends, is your second episode. And what an episode it is. I mean it. Buckle in, folks. Put the kids to bed. Toss in a load of laundry. Throw on a bib. Comb your hair. And make sure you're near a toilet. Because this may very well be the single greatest podcast ever created. I'm being sincere here, people. I am not running off at the mouth or picking out my fish before the butchers tied their shoes. Not this guy, not this fella, not this block of cheese. I'm shooting you straight. So believe me when I tell you that this is one amazingly powerful and life-changing show. Now, I know that I'm a proficient podcasting purveyor of hebetudinous hyperbole, but that doesn't make me a prevaricating podcaster who deals in falsehoods and fabrications. No. I'm just a boy podcasting in front of a girl or another boy, possibly a goat. I'm not really sure. I mean, I can't see all y'all out there. All I'm trying to say, folks, is that today's episode is going to be pretty damn good. And if I'm lying, I'm dying. Okay, I took that a step too far. I don't want to die. So yeah, welcome to the show, folks. This episode is just a bit of all right. Over 40 years ago, in April of 1981, John Byrne began his fabled run on the Fantastic Four. It marked the start of a transformative five-year era, widely regarded as one of the most celebrated chapters in all of Fantastic Four comic book history. Byrne took Marvel's first family and gave them new life, creating stories that combined big ideas with deeply personal moments, a blend that resonated with readers and gave the Fantastic Four renewed relevance and acclaim. Though not every tale could be a classic, the enduring impact of Byrne's approach is undeniable, cementing his run as a major milestone in Marvel Comics. When John Byrne took the reins of Fantastic Four, the title had, in many ways, drifted from the boundary-pushing sci-fi epic that Jack Kirby and Stan Lee had originally created. Byrne aimed to reconnect with those roots, channeling Lee and Kirby's sensibilities while making the book his own. His goal was to restore the Fantastic Four's identity as a family first and superhero team second, a dynamic that had always set them apart from all the other teams in the Marvel Universe. But Byrne didn't just pay homage to the characters, he reinvented the series, and in doing so created new classics that continue to inspire comic writers and artists to this day. Central to Byrne's run was his deep dive into each member of the team, starting with Sue Storm. For decades, Sue had been treated as the group's least powerful member, often relegated to a supporting role behind her male teammates. Byrne changed that, giving Sue more agency, expanding her powers, and transforming her into a formidable force in her own right. Perhaps the most memorable moment came when Byrne rechristened her as the Invisible Woman, rather than the Invisible Girl. A symbolic but powerful shift that acknowledged her growth and strength. Sue's character became more layered, balancing her roles as a superhero, a wife, a mother, and the emotional core of the team. Byrne's work on Sue made her one of the most complex female characters in Marvel Comics at the time, and his portrayal helped to pave the way for future writers to explore her in new and dynamic ways. Reed Richards, Marvel's resident super genius, also faced fresh challenges under Byrne's pen. Reed had always been a somewhat paternal figure, his intellect and unflinching rationality driving his decisions as leader. Byrne explored the moral gray areas of Reed's character, sometimes putting him at odds with the team and even with his own sense of ethics. Whether he was grappling with the unintended consequences of his inventions or the ethical implications of his experiments, Reed was pushed into territory that tested his role as Mr. Fantastic,
This layered exploration added a more human element to Reed, transforming him from a stoic scientist into a man wrestling with the burdens of his own brilliance. Meanwhile, Byrne gave Ben Grimm, The Thing, an arc that resonated on both humorous and tragic levels. As the heart of the Fantastic Four, Ben had always been a fan favorite, his rocky exterior and gruff demeanor hiding a sensitive, loyal friend. But Byrne delved even deeper into Ben's struggle with his identity, exploring how he coped with being permanently transformed into a monster and the impact this had on his psyche and relationships. Ben's journey under Byrne was both moving and empowering, adding new dimensions to a character who had long been defined by his personal appearance. Johnny Storm, the Human Torch, also experienced substantial growth. While Johnny had often been portrayed as the team's impulsive kid brother, Byrne worked to mature his character, placing him in situations that forced him to consider the weight of his actions. One such storyline involved Johnny accidentally killing a member of the alien Skrull race in self-defense, a choice that haunted him and led to some soul-searching. Byrne succeeded in deepening Johnny's character without sacrificing his sense of fun, adding to the family dynamic that drove the series. Beyond the characters, Byrne brought the Fantastic Four into realms of high-concept science fiction and cosmic exploration, expanding the scope of their universe in ways that captivated readers. His run introduced iconic storylines like the trial of Reed Richards, where Reed was held accountable for his decision to save Galactus, a being capable of wiping out entire worlds. It was a daring story that tested the moral fabric of the Marvel Universe and questioned the ethics of heroism. Byrne also took the FF to Galactus's homeworld, gave readers a tour of the Negative Zone, and reintroduced Dr. Doom as a terrifying, complex villain, emphasizing Doom's intellect and strategic cunning in ways that made him feel like a true nemesis. Byrne's art, coupled with his storytelling, also added to the appeal of the series. His clean, dynamic line work conveyed both the grandeur of space adventures and the intimacy of the team's interactions, ensuring that each issue was as visually engaging as it was narratively compelling. From the high-tech laboratories of the Baxter Building to the far reaches of space, Byrne's visuals created a vivid and immersive world. Though I haven't picked up a Fantastic Four comic in a while, like a decade, Byrne's work remains foundational, a kind of blueprint for anyone trying to capture the magic of Marvel's first family. His run didn't just celebrate the past. It reinvented the Fantastic Four and set a new standard for superhero comics. Even today, elements of Byrne's era echo through Marvel's stories, a testament to his incredible influence and a reminder that the best comic runs are timeless. And it all started with that one issue, Fantastic Four number 232. And that's the comic that I want to talk about today. The issue sports a cover date of July 1981, though it hit the stands in April. It sold for just 50 cents, and it is entitled Back to Basics. It was written by John Byrne with both pencils and inks by John Byrne. The letters were by Jim Novak, and the colorist was Glynis Wien.
Stephen or Else will return after these messages.
Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. Oh me, oh my. Whatever am I gonna do now?
Well, what's wrong there, friend?
Well, it's my comic books. I have so many of them, and they aren't worth a dime.
Well, that ain't nothing to fret over. One call to CVT will solve your problem.
CVT? What is that?
Not what, friend. Who? CVT is the Comics Value Team.
The Comics Value Team?
Well, that's right, friend. For just a small monthly fee, CVT will not only tell you the value of your comics, well, they're gonna make your comics valuable.
But how can they do that? The man at the comic book store said that my collection was worthless.
Well, that's simple, friend. After cataloging your collection, CVT's value enhancement experts will seek out other copies of the same issues you own and eliminate them, making your collection all the more valuable.
Eliminate them? But how?
Space-age technology, friend, that's how. Why, with their patent-pending fleet of mobile incineration units,
comic book stores will be lining up to buy your collection.
Hey, now that's neat.
It sure is, friend.
Thanks for the advice, stranger. I'm gonna call CVT right now.
The Comics Value Team, turning your average comic book collection into a potential gold mine.
The methods used by the Comics Value Team are not considered legal in all of the 50 United States, except for maybe some areas of Florida and Texas.
And now, back to Stephen or Else. In this issue, the evil alchemist Diablo, he's been living life on the down low for a few months. He's currently residing in a boarding house, and as the issue opens, he's doing his evil things with his evil potions, and he's hatching an evil plot of revenge against the Fantastic Four. He's really into some first-class soliloquizing here. Soliloquizing, is that the right word? He is just freaking talking to himself out loud in the way that villains do. You know, so the reader understands what's going on. Anyway, he's interrupted by Mrs. Mulligan. She's a nice old lady who's actually not nice at all. I was trying to be positive. But no, she's the landlady, and she comes banging on his door to make sure he ain't cooking nothing. After all, those smoky potions he's got going on, they gotta be filling the house with quite the stink. Well, Diablo assumes the identity of a sweet-looking old man and assures Mrs. Mulligan that he's not cooking. She leaves, and he immediately gets back to it and unleashes something to crush the Fantastic Four. What that something is, we don't quite know yet, but we're soon to find out. We cut to the Casa Tendellini hair salon where Sue Richards, or the Invisible Woman, she's getting herself a new do. Everything seems to be peachy keen when suddenly the salon is attacked by some sort of dirt monster. She tries to go invisible to take it on, but it quickly encases her in dirt, allowing it to see her. Meanwhile, Ben Grimm, the Thang, and his lady friend, do you think anybody ever just calls him the Thang? What's up, Thang? I doubt it. Anyway, he and his lady friend, Alicia Masters, they're leaving a Broadway performance of The Elephant Man. Ben has been moved to tears by the show. He is bawling like a giant rock baby. It begins to rain, and it doesn't take long for Ben to realize that it's only raining on him. But before he can even think about how freaking weird that is, he is suddenly surrounded in a bubble of water. He tries to break free so that he doesn't drown, but he's not having any luck at all. In Central Park, Johnny Storm, the Human Torch, he meets up with Frankie Ray. Apparently, the two used to be a thing. Not a thang, but a thing. But anyway, she had a real problem with him using his powers, which, you know what? If you're going to date the Human Torch, get past that. Either don't date the man or get past it. They try to talk it out when Johnny is suddenly attacked by a creature made of air. Are you starting to see the pattern here? Okay, Invisible Woman, Dirt Monster, The Thing, Water Monster, and now Johnny, a air monster. In case you don't see the pattern, here's one more for you. In the Baxter Building, the headquarters of the Fantastic Four, Reed Richards, or Mr. Fantastic, he's doing science, as he is known to do. He's in his lab, he's doing science, and he's attacked by a creature made of fire. That's right, if you guessed that the Fantastic Four are being attacked by the band Earth, Wind, and Fire, you'd be, well, you'd be wrong. Anyway, Reed escapes the fire creature by turning himself into a ball and bouncing the heck out of there. Once outside, he stretches out like a sail, and he glides on over to Central Park where, lo and behold, he runs into Frankie Ray. She tells Reed that Johnny has been attacked by a wild thing and needs help. Not to be confused by the song. There seems to be a lot of song musical references in here. We've got Earth, Wind, and Fire, and now Wild Thing. And I don't think it's making Johnny's heart sing. Anyway, Reed quickly tracks him down and tries to smother the wind creature when fire arrives, and Reed's giant brain deduces that they might fare better were they to switch opponents. And so they do just that, tag team style. Back at the hair salon, Sue uses her invisible force field to burst out of her dirt prison and then make her escape out into the city where she searches for the rest of the team. It's here where Byrne begins introducing new elements to the Fantastic Four mythos by having the Invisible Woman use her force field to lift her up and propel her down the street. Meanwhile, still surrounded by water and almost out of breath, Ben is still able to remain mobile, and he smashes into a sporting goods store where he is given a scuba tank by a friendly customer. Water doesn't like this and tries to drown the customer instead. And so Ben, having no real choice in the matter, hands the scuba tank over to save her life, leaving himself open once again for a drowning. But as water jumps at Ben, the creature is repelled away by one of Sue's force fields, who has shown up just in the nick of time. She then traps water in an invisible force bubble while Ben goes on out to take care of the dirt monster, or, as we're calling it, Earth. Reed arrives and he does what he does best. He does science. He has Sue free the water creature and instead capture the air creature in her bubble. Reed then grabs a pair of jumper cables that are just lying around on the ground and destroys the water using electricity. Science! Then he tells Ben to open a water main and use the water to turn the dirt monster into mud, destroying another foe. Science! Then at last, he has Sue increase the pressure within her force bubble, which forces the air creature, who is a gas form, into a liquid form, which then destroys it. Science! But what about Johnny and the fire creature? Fear not, true believers! High above the city, Johnny unleashes his Nova Flame, which consumes all of the oxygen around them, thus causing the fire creature to extinguish. And, like the others, the creature is destroyed. Science! Back at the Baxter building, Reed explains to Ben and Sue that the creatures that they fought were elementals. And besides Dr. Doom, who would never resort to such crude methods? The only other foe of theirs that would use alchemy against them is Diablo. But how can that be? Ben points out that Diablo died when they last fought. And of course, Reed explains that they never saw a body, man. This is comics. You don't see a body, there's no death. He also explains that Diablo has escaped certain death before, and so it has to be him. It just has to be. But Reed's a science dude, and he has nothing he can use to trace mystical energies, so he makes a call. Later that night, as Diablo tries to skip town, he is confronted by the Fantastic Four, who have enlisted the help of Doctor Strange to track him down. So the Fantastic Four take their foe away in the Fantastic Car, leaving Doctor Strange alone in a dark alley. I'm sure Doctor Strange has a way to get home, but still, that seemed kind of weird. But there you have it, the debut issue of John Byrne's Fantastic Four. And most of what I read nowadays are old books. Not because I'm a crusty old man who's stuck in his ways and who thinks that the books these days aren't near as good as they used to be. The books these days, these kids read. That's not the way I am. No. For me, it all comes down to money. I can't afford a monthly comics habit, so instead, I have two things. A monthly subscription to Comixology Unlimited and a library card. With that, it's just easier to read the old stuff. There's some fairly new stuff out there, and I do read the occasional Image book, but just trying to get back into Marvel and DC these days just feels darn near impossible. But the point I'm trying to make is that because I'm reading these old books, I like to take circumstances like John Byrne's Fantastic Four issue and try to imagine how that would be done today. When a writer is put on a new book, they typically have the first 6 to 12 months mapped out. Of course, I'm just assuming based on articles and such that I read. I'm not sure that every writer does that, but I feel like at the very least, most writers go into a title knowing the big story they want to tell, and many probably have an ending in mind. How they then go about telling that big story can differ, but for many, they are at the very least planting a lot of seeds right in that first issue, if not just jumping right into the big story right away. With this Fantastic Four tale, you got it done in one. It feels to me, more like Byrne just flexing his muscles. The next few issues are done in ones as well. And again, this is just conjecture, but to me, this is Byrne just easing into things. He's trying on the pants and he's walking around the store. He's pulling the egg carton from the cooler and he's inspecting each egg to ensure that none of them are cracked. Now, don't get me wrong. There's something very exciting about reading the first issue to a new writer's run and knowing once you hit the end that you are in for some pretty epic stuff. But at the same time, every story can't be epic and life-changing. I mean, after a while, it gets a bit boring, right? And really, the only thing out there that can excite my fanboy mind
are the small stories or the one-offs, like number 232 of Fantastic Four. Was it the best issue I've ever read? No, far from it. But it was fun, and in the end, that's all I need.
I learn something new every day. For example, did you know that back during the golden age of radio, they were using records to record radio shows? It's true. They were called electric transcription discs, also known as ETs or platters, and they were crucial to the operation of radio during the 1930s and the 1940s. Now, unlike the commercial records of the time, which were typically no more than 12 inches in diameter and played at 78 RPMs, transcription discs were often 16 inches across and spun at 33 and a third RPMs. This larger size and slower speed allowed them to hold up to 15 minutes of audio per side, making them ideal for full-length radio shows. But these platters weren't just about size. They boasted higher fidelity and lower surface noise compared to consumer records. The process to create these discs was no different than the process used for commercial records, which involved cutting a master recording into a blank wax or acetate disc. That master was then coated with metal, which served as a mold for pressing multiple copies. Early versions were made from shellac, but by the mid-1930s, quieter and more durable vinyl compounds became the standard. These platters were an economical way to mass-produce content for radio stations, allowing them to share high-quality broadcasts without the cost or complexity of tape duplication. However, the defining feature of these discs wasn't their size or material. It was the unique Hill and Dale recording method. Unlike standard records where grooves were cut laterally, these discs used vertical cutting, making them incompatible with home phonographs. This intentional incompatibility ensured that the discs wouldn't end up in private collections, keeping them exclusive to radio broadcasters. So how did these discs come to be? It all started in the 1920s, when electrical recording replaced Edison's mechanical recording process. Companies like Marsh Laboratories and Western Electric led the charge, with Freeman Gostin and Charles Correll credited as the first to produce electrical transcriptions in 1928. Their innovation quickly transformed radio programming. Stations could now pre-record shows, rerun popular episodes, and even syndicate programs nationwide without relying on live broadcasts. The practical uses of these discs were vast. During World War II, the U.S. government used transcription discs to distribute programs to troops overseas. Shows like the Treasury Star Parade were pressed onto ETs and sent worldwide, bringing a taste of home to soldiers in far-flung places. Even after the war, transcription discs played a key role in preserving some of radio's most iconic broadcasts, including Orson Welles' legendary War of the Worlds performance. By the 1950s, though, transcription discs began to fade as magnetic tape became the new standard. Tape was cheaper, easier to edit, and more versatile. Yet the legacy of these giant platters lives on as many classic radio programs survived thanks to their sturdy grooves. And that was something I learned today.
Hoping to discover a treasure trove of comics and collectibles, podcast host Stephen Orr stepped through a portal in the back of his closet and vanished. He woke to find himself trapped in the past, facing mirror images that were totally his own, and driven by an unknown force to read the comics of the time and record his thoughts for use on a future podcast. His only device on this journey is Frank, an iPhone 12 Pro Max that has no network to connect to, but still manages to record and store voice memos. And so, Stephen finds himself leaping from time to time, striving to read every comic he can find, and hoping each time that his next leap will be the leap home, and that all his recordings survive the trip.
Today's segment finds me in September of 1941 and features my thoughts on just one of the stories from the anthology comic More Fun Comics number 73. This issue was published by DC Comics. It sold for just 10 cents. And the story I'm talking about features the first appearance of the Green Arrow. It was written by Mort Weisinger with art by George Popp.
So we start out, we see a mystery man in a black hat. He's wearing a purple cloak and he's got this white mask. And he shoots a man named George Lincoln. He shoots him in the back in the man's own home. Abraham Lincoln died by the gun, and so do you. That's my villain voice for this guy. Next, the very same murderous mystery man hangs millionaire John Hale. The noose was good enough for your namesake. Then at the home of Anthony Caesar, the murderer strikes again, stabbing the oil tycoon to death. Julius Caesar died by the knife, the same to you. So yeah, he looks kind of like a low-rent shadow. He's got a big hat, big wide-brimmed hat, and he's got this scarf-like mask that covers his face, and he's got a purple cloak, and he's just killing folk, one after the other, and he's killing them in the same way as their historical namesakes. The next day, we find Oliver Queen and Roy Harper, better known as the Green Arrow and Speedy, the Cyclone Kid, hanging in the apartment they share together. So they're in their apartment. They're looking forward to a well-deserved vacation following the case of the Golden Mummy when, from a radio nearby, they hear a disturbing report. Newsflash! The police are still baffled by the mysterious murders of three members of the famous History Club last night. No clues, etc., etc. That's not me paraphrasing. They actually put that in the comic book. Well, that's all the two need to spring into action. They race through an underground tunnel, emerging into a secret garage, and the fastest car on wheels. The aeroplane! Yeah, the aeroplane. Get it? Get it? Aeroplane? Aeroplane? Airplane? Get it? It actually does look like an airplane with no wings. When they reach the History Club, Speedy triggers a mechanism that launches Green Arrow from the car and through an upper floor window of the club. A window, I might add, that is closed. So he crashes through a freaking closed window, breaking and shattering the glass all over the place for no other reason than, as he puts it, it's a faster way than using the stairs. Of course, none of the surviving members of the club seem to mind, however, and they introduce themselves to Green Arrow. Ezra Sampson, the treasurer, Frank Darcy, the president, along with Amos Socrates and Leonard Achilles. The club is literally just dudes who all share names with historical figures. I mean, how does something like that get started? Hello, my name's Amos Socrates. Well, howdy, I'm Leonard Achilles. Well, hey, we both got names of famous people. We should start a club. Yeehaw! I should also point out here that Ezra Sampson, he's a short guy. I'm not just pointing that out because I like to point at people. Ha ha, look, he's short. Ha ha, look at him. Ha ha ha. No, that actually, it means something. We'll learn what that means later, but it's a clue. Achilles tells Green Arrow that he is next in line to die. Not Green Arrow, Achilles. He's saying, hey, Green Arrow, just so you're aware, I'm next in line to die. I got a threat, and so, you know, I know that I'm next. And because Achilles, the historical Greek figure, he had his one weakness. He died by being stabbed in the heel. That's where the Achilles heel thing comes from. But don't worry, though. Leonard Achilles, knowing that these other guys died the same sort of way that their historical namesakes died, he has taken some action to avoid being stabbed in the heel. So how does he combat this? He wears metal boots. That can't be comfortable. I have to imagine that metal boots don't have a lot of give. But here's the thing. Green Arrow points out that what if that's what the killer wanted him to do? It's all part of his plan. Yes, he wanted Achilles to wear metal boots because he's placed an electrical panel in the floor underneath the carpet. And as soon as Leonard Achilles in his metal boots walks across it, zap, he's dead. And so as Green Arrow bends to remove the rug to discover the metal plate, a bullet just whizzes through the open window over his head. He's bending the air, let's just push. Pa-kew! This bullet, shading right over his head. Very lucky. Green Arrow leaps to the window. He fires a rope arrow, walking the line like a tightrope to the opposite building where a man with a gun flees. Speedy joins Green Arrow and they give chase. Well, look who's joining in the skunk hunt, Green Arrow says to Speedy. I catapulted up here just in time, methinks.
Which is, Speedy's clever reply. The gunman, in the meantime, has made it to another building. But before he can get any further, the two archers let loose, pinning the man to a pigeon coop. And as the guy is stuck to this pigeon coop with, you know, his freaking sleeves and his pant legs pinned to the wall by arrows, he says, "Them guys could thread a needle with an arrow." And so, with the thug being trapped, Green Arrow uses the opportunity to grill him. Turns out, believe it or not, the guy's name is Muggsy. And the mysterious murderer, who Muggsy calls the Chief, commanded him to shoot, or as he put it, plug, Green Arrow if he dared set foot in the club. Unfortunately, dear Muggsy has no idea who the Chief is, because he's always masked. But not all is lost, however, because Muggsy announces that he's meeting the Chief and the gang down at the hideout at 5. And so they drop Muggsy off with the police, and then Green Arrow disguises himself as the thug to infiltrate the gang. His disguise lasts about 5 minutes, maybe 4. I mean, he shows up to the club and he's like, "Hey, fellas, it's Muggsy." And then the Chief says, "All right, fellas, the next one who's gonna die is Darcy. He's next. By the way, Muggsy's a traitor." And everybody's like, "What?" And they grab him, and they go, and the mystery dude says, "Lift up his hand." And there on his hand, his right hand, are all 5 fingers. Why is that a big deal? Because Muggsy only had 4. And besides, once they wrestle him to the ground and take his hat off, they can see that he's still wearing his Green Arrow mask. I don't know what he was thinking there. Maybe if he kept the brim of his hat down low enough, they wouldn't notice the mask. Really? Silly stuff. So anyway, they tie the Green Arrow to a chair, and another thug arrives with Speedy, whom he found outside snooping around. And so with both of the wizard archers tied to chairs, our villain leaves, but not before turning on the gas, so that the two will be dead. "Dead as William Tell," he says, by the time he returns. The gas is making them weak, and they can't slip free. So Green Arrow has an idea. He slips his right shoe loose with his left, and he kicks it through the window. And like that, the gas is gone. And by the very next panel, they are back in the aeroplane, and Green Arrow is back in costume. I find it really odd that they keep skipping over just these really big events. They're trying to, you know, squish this story into like maybe 6 pages. And so they skip over a lot of stuff, but the writer has to really point out certain things to us. Like, well, for example, how he was able to get his shoe loose. He makes it a point to let us know that he kicks off his right shoe using his left foot. I don't really need to know that. I don't have to bend my imagination that far to understand how he gets a shoe loose and kicks it off of his foot. Now, how they then got out of the ropes and down to the aeroplane, that might have been something that he maybe wanted to kind of point out. But nope, too busy telling us how he got that shoe off of his foot. But now that they're free, they head to Darcy's home, since our villain announced that Darcy was going to be next. When they arrive, they see smoke pouring out of an open window. And as Green Arrow once again uses the aeroplane seat catapult to launch him through that window, a second story window, he shouts out for the world to hear that the window has been left open so that the draft will feed the flames. Again, another really oddly specific detail the writer felt needed an explanation. Anyway, Green Arrow finds Darcy tied, standing up to his 4-post bed, and frees him. Darcy, however, is concerned about Green Arrow's escape plan. They're trapped in a room, and they can't leap from the window, being on the second story and all. Green Arrow tells them not to worry. They won't be able to leap out, but they sure will be able to walk out. Because see, Speedy's out there on the lawn, and he fires a series of arrows into the side of the house, creating a makeshift ladder for the two to climb down. And as they're climbing down, Green Arrow, again, with one of his witty comments, says, "This is what they mean by the straight and arrow path." Once out on the lawn and safe, Darcy tells the archers that Ezra Sampson is next on the list, because he too received a threat. And so they arrive at Samson's office to find him gagged and bound to a chair with a bomb at his feet. The bomb is one of those cartoony black globes with the burning fuse. And to defuse it, Green Arrow shoots the water cooler, which pours water all over the bomb, smothering it and dousing the fuse. Back at the apartment, Green Arrow examines the bomb, confident that it will provide a clue to the killer's identity. Speedy muses that the killer must be Amos Socrates, as he's the only one who hasn't been either killed or had an attempt on his life. Plus, he's tall. Make note of that. Green Arrow is none too hip on Speedy's theory, but decides they should visit Socrates just in case. They arrive at the studio of Amos Socrates and peer in through the window from outside. Inside, they see that the mysterious villain is already there and is forcing Socrates to drink poison at gunpoint. He hasn't actually ingested any of the poison yet. He's just standing there with the gun. Drink the poison, boy! Not to worry, though. Green Arrow fires two arrows into the room. One takes out the gun, the other takes out the cup. It's kind of funny, though, that the writer doesn't seem to be too concerned with explaining how Green Arrow got inside the room to fire the arrows. I mean, literally in the previous panel, he's outside, looking in through a closed window. We need to know how he got his shoe off, but we shouldn't really concern ourselves with how Green Arrow fired off two arrows into a room from the outside through a closed window. Oh well, I'm not going to worry about it. I'm out of here, cries our villain as the arrow knocks the gun from his hand. The next panel, we do see Green Arrow standing at the window, and all is explained. He's outside, but one of the window panes is missing. It's also here that we see the masked villain running away. What you don't really notice, however, is there's an arrow sticking out of his calf. It's really hard to see. However, the text box tells us, as the mystery murderer flees, an arrow strikes him in the foot. This is very important. We'll find out why soon. In the very next panel, however, we see our villain pinned to the wall by arrows, just as Muggsy was earlier. We go from the villain fleeing right to him being caught with only a text box as an explanation. After a short chase, the masked man is cornered in a corridor, and in a brief moment, he is pinned to the wall by Green Arrow and Speedy. Seems like a bit of an exciting scene to just take out. We don't get to see any of it. Seems a bit odd. The villain at this point is revealed to be Ezra Samson. But wait! Samson was a short dude, remember? And our villain is tall. Turns out, Samson is wearing stilts to make him taller. And that's why the arrow didn't harm him. Oh, I get it. That makes sense. And as we're coming to this conclusion, Samson somehow gets loose and jumps out a window, running away. We don't see how this happens. Just boom, he's out on the lawn running away. Try to take me, Green Arrow! Ha ha ha! That's what he's shouting as he's running across the lawn. We then get a three-panel car chase in which Green Arrow shoots out a tire on Samson's car while driving with his knees, mind you. They point that out. And then, well, for the text box, Samson's car swerves crazily and then plunges over an embankment. A mass of twisted and tangled steel forms a coffin for the arch criminal. Wow, that's freaking dark. Now, Green Arrow is telling Speedy that he had deduced that Samson was the killer because he discovered that the bomb meant to blow Samson up had been filled with harmless powder. It was a fake bomb, meaning that the attempt on Samson's life was staged so that Green Arrow wouldn't suspect him. But hold on a minute, I'm a little confused here. Samson, as the masked killer, last left Green Arrow and Speedy tied up in a room filling with gas. Is Green Arrow saying that Samson knew they were going to get free? It makes you think, right? Is that why villains set up these elaborate death plans? Because they know they're going to escape? Why else would he stage his own death? Anyway, we learned that Samson, who was the treasurer of the History Club, had been embezzling the club funds and planned on framing Socrates by making his death look like a suicide. The story ends with Green Arrow and Speedy back at their apartment. Green Arrow is placing the fake bomb in their trophy case, along with all their other souvenirs of past cases. Then we get a panel showing an arrow going through some nameless thug's hand, forcing him to drop his gun, and a text box that says, "But other daring criminals will arise to add more trophies to the Green Arrow's collection. See the Wizard Archers combat another crime carnival next month." Very, very dramatic. I enjoyed this story for what it was. The art wasn't great. This did look a bit rushed. The story was a bit silly, but it was... I'm not going to give it a lot of crap. I had a lot of good laughs reading the book.
Hey, wasn't that fun? That audio was originally recorded in September of 1941 and not, as some may claim, a highly edited version of an episode of Just Another Fanboy from May of 2020. It's best that you just accept the whole time travel thing and try not to dwell too much on any other possible explanations, regardless of how logical or sane they may be. Instead, how about we try and distract you with 30 seconds of nonsense? One of my biggest hopes in life is to one day ride a fish. You know, like a horse. Just strap on a saddle and some scuba gear and let her rip. Think of the freedom. If only I could make this dream come true, then maybe I could move on to the next. The next dream on my list, underwater cowboy. I'm talking about revolutionizing the fishing industry here, folks. I'm talking about a good old-fashioned fish drive. Because believe me, there's nothing like bringing in a school of fish.
30 Seconds of Nonsense has been brought to you by the Mitchell McKenzie School of Fish Wrangling. Sign up today and you'll be roping fish by Christmas.
Now I want you to picture this scene in your head. Everyone around the world is going about their daily business when, out of nowhere, giant flying saucers appear over every major city around the globe. The people of the Earth huddle around their television sets, glued to the news, anxiously waiting any updates on these mysterious hovering discs. Are they friendly? Are they a threat? What is the fate of the Earth? Sounds a little bit like the big-budget Will Smith 1996 summer blockbuster Independence Day, doesn't it? Well, guess what? It's not Independence Day. It's the premise of V, the original TV miniseries, which aired in 1983 and brought audiences an early taste of sci-fi alien invasion themes that would echo in cinema and television for decades. This two-part miniseries captured the attention of millions of viewers and became a cultural phenomenon in its own right. So that's why today I'm taking a deep dive into V, a precursor to modern sci-fi spectacles and an unexpectedly poignant piece of social commentary, all wrapped up in, well, a whole lot of cheese.
Tonight is your chance to see how it all began, to relive the excitement that is V, the most extraordinary miniseries ever. A daring TV journalist struggling to uncover the startling truth behind the aliens' visit to Earth. And a beautiful and brave young scientist fighting for the very survival of the human race. Together, they take you on a fantastic journey to meet the visitors. Prepare yourself for a television event that's out of this world. Prepare for V. Next.
V begins with a familiar but unsettling scenario. Alien ships appear in the sky above Earth's major cities, casting ominous shadows over familiar skylines. Unlike the blitz of destruction one might expect in an alien invasion story, the aliens, known as the Visitors, arrive under a banner of peace. They look human with their 70s hair and blue blocker sunglasses, they speak our language, and they claim to be in desperate need of our help. They say that their home planet is running out of a crucial resource and that Earth's industries are uniquely suited to manufacture it. In return, they promise technological advancements and wisdom that could propel humanity into a golden era. Needless to say, people welcome them with open arms. I mean, why wouldn't they? Sounds like a good deal, right? Well, it doesn't take long for cracks in the visitors' facade to show. The truth, as revealed by courageous journalist Mike Donovan, is far more sinister. Mike Donovan, by the way, is played by Mark Singer, otherwise known as the Beastmaster. Anyway, Donovan discovers that these aliens are actually reptilian creatures hiding behind human-like masks. They are not here to share knowledge or to make friends, but to strip the Earth of its water and enslave or consume its inhabitants. Their supposed benevolence is a cover for resource plundering and a full-scale invasion. What starts as a seemingly hopeful sci-fi exploration of first contact quickly pivots into a terrifying scenario with echoes of our darkest historical chapters. At its core, V is more than a sci-fi action thriller. The series borrows heavily from World War II imagery and Nazi symbolism. The visitors' uniforms are a bold blood red, adorned with a logo that bears a striking resemblance to the swastika, subtly cueing viewers to the parallel between the aliens and the Nazi regime. Their hierarchy, complete with a chilling leader, John, who oozes charm and menace, mimics the totalitarian structure of the Nazi Party. This isn't just a tale of extraterrestrial invasion. It's a layered warning against fascism and blind acceptance. One of the series' most unsettling aspects is the visitors' campaign against Earth's scientists. They systematically scapegoat the scientific community, claiming that they are the only ones capable of undermining the visitors' technology and exposing their true nature. Thus, scientists and their families are hunted, persecuted, and forced into hiding. Schools teach anti-scientist propaganda, and children are encouraged to report anyone who associates with them. A chilling reminder of the Hitler Youth programs that brainwashed young Germans. This anti-scientist crusade is absurd on the surface, lending itself to the campy feel of the series. Yet it's also remarkably prescient. V critiques how totalitarian regimes manipulate fear and misinformation to divide and control the populace. By exaggerating the threat posed by scientists, the visitors craft a common enemy that distracts humanity from the real danger hovering above them. Mark Singer's character, Mike Donovan, is the series' quintessential 80s action hero, embodying the rugged individualism and undaunted courage of a sci-fi protagonist. A cameraman and war correspondent, Donovan isn't a scientist or a soldier. He's just an ordinary man thrust into extraordinary circumstances. His discovery of the visitor's true form catalyzes the human resistance. Without him, Earth might have been subdued before any real opposition could form. As a reporter, Donovan represents the power of truth in the face of deception, showing that knowledge and courage can be more potent weapons than guns or lasers. His arc underscores the series' message that the real fight is not just against an alien species, but against the suppression of information and truth. The ragtag band of resistance fighters he joins is composed of diverse backgrounds and beliefs, emphasizing the strength that comes from unity. The message is clear. The thing that divides us must be put aside if we are to face a threat to our collective freedom. And then there's Juliet Parrish, played by Faye Grant, the scientist who becomes one of the primary leaders of the human resistance. Juliet is driven, resourceful, and compassionate, embodying the best qualities of her profession. Unlike Donovan, who's all about action, Juliet brings a sense of hope and optimism, reminding us that resilience is as much about caring for one another as it is about winning the fight. Together, Donovan and Juliet symbolize the balance of heart and intellect necessary to confront seemingly insurmountable challenges. Now, for a miniseries made in the early 80s, V pulled off some impressive visual effects, especially given the limitations of television budgets at the time. The visitor motherships, massive saucers hovering ominously over cities, are iconic. This imagery is reminiscent of similar scenes from Independence Day, suggesting that V paved the way for future alien invasion narratives. The motherships create an instant visual threat, looming silently, ever-present, yet still and serene until the action kicks in. The transformation sequences, in which we see glimpses of the aliens' true reptilian faces beneath their human disguises, are especially memorable. Seeing the visitors' faces peel off to reveal scales and slitted eyes was an effect that struck horror and fascination into audiences at the time. It's a bit cheesy by today's standards, but back then, those moments were pure nightmare fuel. The series also pioneered the use of practical effects for the visitors' diet. There's a particularly infamous scene involving a visitor devouring a live rodent, a moment so unsettling it burned itself into the minds of viewers and added a layer of visceral horror to these seemingly benevolent creatures. Despite its camp and occasional melodrama, V left a lasting impact on pop culture. It spawned a sequel, V the Final Battle, as well as a short-lived TV series in 1984. The concept was even revived in 2009, though the reboot never quite captured the gritty tension and cult appeal of the original. Still, V set the stage for television miniseries as a viable format for ambitious storytelling, blending science fiction with thought-provoking themes. Watching V today is like a trip back in time, not just to the 1980s, but to a period when television dared to tackle significant issues through storytelling. Yeah, it's cheesy, whether it's Mark Singer's over-the-top bravado, the hammy performances, or the undeniably 80s haircuts. But beneath the camp lies a story that's oddly timeless. As we look around the world today, V's themes of propaganda, persecution, and resistance resonate perhaps even more strongly than they did in 1983. It's like a cult classic that missed the classic part by just an inch. I mean, the themes are there. Resistance, loyalty, betrayal, power, it's all ripe for a gritty reboot. But in 1983, the cheese factor was dialed up to 11, and that's what makes it such a fun guilty pleasure. You don't watch V for a nuanced take on totalitarianism or the perils of blind trust. You watch it for Mark Singer firing laser guns at giant lizards and for aliens in red jumpsuits trying to act like they're just your average peace-loving neighbors. So do I recommend it? Well, if you've never seen V, go in with an open mind, a sense of humor, and maybe an edible or two. Embrace the cheese, enjoy the melodrama. And when those aliens come on screen in their blue blocker sunglasses and start brainwashing the youth into turning in their scientist parents, just lean in and enjoy the wild, nostalgic ride. Because there's a little piece of 1983 in there that's just so absurd, it's almost brilliant. There you go, folks, the end of the show. Next week, you can look forward to even more chaotic confusion as we travel back to 1986 for the birth of the new universe over at Marvel Comics. And we'll look at the new universe's flagship title, Star Brand Number One. Plus, along with everything you never wanted to know about the human circulatory system, you'll learn what an apartment goat is. You'll get 30 more seconds of nonsense, and I will take a look at a movie from 1983 that makes me feel like a hoser each and every time I watch it. And oh yeah, more Franks and Beans. Until then, folks, I leave you with this one final thought. There's nothing wrong with eating a taco over the sink as long as you make direct eye contact with anyone who walks in and catches you doing it. I mean, you got to assert that dominance, people. And of course, be nice to each other. Bye. I want to thank you for listening to Stephen or Else. This episode was written, performed, produced, engineered, and edited by me, Stephen Orr. Questions and comments can be directed to StephenOrElse@gmail.com, or you can find me online at all the regular places by searching for @StephenOrElse. If you enjoyed the show, you can help to boost our presence online by leaving a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. I also invite you to join our subscription program, Stephen or Else Beyond. And in return, you'll get episodes of Stephen or Else, along with every other show under the Stephen or Else Media umbrella, early and ad-free. Check out the link in the show notes or just go to StephenOrElse.com to join today. The Stephen or Else podcast is a presentation of Stephen or Else Media. For more nerdy content created by me, check out SoManyPodcasts.com. All links will be in the show notes.
I don't think I can move through life knowing that a guy named Steven did this to me.
How could you let this happen, Steven?
Your podcast sucks.
Hail to the king, baby.
Steven! Thank God. I had a horrible feeling I was going to be the only one here.
There's always next time, Steven.
Live on DAZN Worldwide.
Saudi Arabia.
Saturday, May 3rd, 7 p.m. Eastern. Canelo versus Skull. The king stakes his legacy once more for the undisputed crown. Standing in his way is Warrior Skull, undefeated and poised to decimate the division on a knockout weekend of boxing.
Let's make history.
Get Canelo versus Skull, Saturday, May 3rd, 7 p.m. Eastern, live exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.